netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. In this episode, our guest is ILM's John Knoll, VFX supervisor for The Mandalorian and Grogu. In the conversation, John walks us through the miniature Razorcrest shoot inside a purpose-built 8-foot LED volume, the Shikari street environment, which was a real location with a tracked LED wall extension, as well as other work from the film. John and Mike also talk about some of the history of VFX in the Star Wars franchise, including discussion of the Star Wars style book and how it's changed and evolved over the years. It's a cool perspective, since for many artists our age, we were inspired by the VFX of the early films, and frankly caused us to want to start a career path that didn't really exist at the time in the way it does now. So let's go ahead and cross the conversation now.
John, thanks so much for joining us. I think last time we spoke, it was when you'd done Skeleton Crew, yeah? Your pedigree or history with Star Wars is obviously incredibly deep. I was going to say, actually, start by asking you, like, what does Star Wars kind of, I don't say mean to you, but I mean, like, how do you feel about it professionally? Like, do you feel protective of it? Do you feel it's going home, or is it any different to any other film that you're working on?
Well, yeah, it's fun and comfortable. It's a world I'm familiar with, and I enjoy working in that world and with the people I've been working with on it. My attachment to Star Wars goes all the way back to that being a catalyst that got me interested in working in the film industry in the first place. So it's sort of a special property in that regard.
I have the most vivid memory of sitting about two rows from the front as the ship came over the head in the first episode, and it just kept on coming, and it just kept on coming, and I swear to God, that's why I'm sitting here today. So yeah,
I've heard a lot of similar accounts of people who are have become very successful in industry, and in interviews, they will often point to Star Wars as being a turning point for them. That, and it was for me as well. That it felt like something had really changed in how motion pictures were being made. That, you know, suddenly the level of suspension of disbelief that was required for, you know, seeing very ambitious sci-fi content, suddenly, you know, you were less aware of all the artifice because it was so much better made. And it felt like, boy, all kinds of things are possible now if they can do this. And that was certainly the reaction I had to it, was that, wow, there's a lot of exciting new things and all kinds of content is possible now. And boy, this is a field I want to be in.
As a very young man, I walked out of Empire thinking, I can't imagine how I can live in a world that makes me wait for the third film to find out what happens. Like, I just couldn't conceive how I was going to get through life. It was almost interminable. So back then, as you said, it changed filmmaking. It's been through, and you've pioneered many of those iterations of technological advances. Is it still the same Star Wars aesthetic, even though the tech has fundamentally shifted many times over? Is there an inherent Star Wars look for you?
There's a style book, and the style book shifts a little bit almost with every outing. When we started on the prequels, we looked at, okay, what do starfields look like? And what do blasters look like? What do lightsabers look like? Because we wanted to develop the sort of the style book for all those sorts of things. And it was remarkable how inconsistent they were in the original trilogy, that starfields are, you know, the stars are white in some shots and they're sort of a bluish tone in others, and they're denser in some and sparser in others. And the laser blasts are all over the place. You know, they look a little bit different in almost every shot. And yeah, same with the lightsabers. There was really a very little consistency there. And so then it was kind of up to us to look through and find our favorite shots. Like, well, I really like this starfield from these shots in Empire Strikes Back. Okay, that's going to be the standard look. That this is what we're going to emulate for our space shots. And for the blasters, there were some things that I felt were a little lacking in the originals. Like, they weren't motion blurred in the original films.
Right.
And that always sort of bothered me that they looked a bit strobey, and that really you want to see what appears to be some motion blur on them. So we did sort of a javelin kind of shape that had a noticeable smear on the leading and trailing edges. And you know, the how bright the lightsaber is and how the glow falls off is something that we tried to be consistent about there. And those things have evolved. In fact, you know, it used to be Star Trek and Star Wars had very different style books, and they have converged a little bit over the years. As an example, I think in the original trilogy, we see shields depicted just a couple of times. Like the Falcon gets hit with a laser blast and there's sort of a shield effect on it. And it's sort of a conformal shield. You know, the energy is on the hull of the ship. So it's like the hull is charged up, and that's what a shield is in Star Wars. And in Star Trek, at least starting with Next Generation, they would do these ellipsoid bubbles around the ship. And you know, something would hit that shield and you'd see this, you know, this ellipsoid.
You worked on Star Trek back in the day, right?
Yeah. But you know, they had these distinctly different looks to the shields, and then my good friend Ben Morris in London, when he was doing Episode 8, did ellipsoidal Star Trek style shields on those. And they look good, but you know, it was a style book change there. And then my good friend Roger Guyette on Force Awakens was, you know, listen, we were revisiting Star Wars again after a pretty big gap from Revenge of the Sith. And he did a different style of blasters. The blasters there were teardrop shaped. So they would have, okay, sort of had a rounded front and a tapered, yep, tail to them. And the leading edge was not motion blurred. And I think the rationale was, hey, if you're looking at a still frame, you want to be able to tell which direction it's going. And that's certainly a valid rationale. But on Rogue One, which was the next film down the line, I said, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. They strobe for me. I see all those non-motion blurred leading edges, so I'm going back to javelins. to some extent, we had these competing style books.
I must say, I do love that film. Rogue One is like a favorite of mine. Is there anything then, given that there are different styles now, like in the Star Wars universe, like Andor and stuff, is there anything that you would immediately look at in dailies or whatever and say, that's just not Star Wars? Because, I mean, it's technically going to be there.
Well, the style book sort of contains a lot of things, you know, that, and some of them are shared with Star Trek. When you see ships in space, you know, everybody agrees on an upward direction.
Yes.
And it's usually, you know, relatively planar. So, you know, all the ships sort of, you know, come together on a plane. They do that in Star Trek as well.
Star Trek particularly likes lighting up their ships externally, which has never made a lot of sense to me, but very good for visuals on a similar audience.
I liked that. You know, that Trumbull brought that to Star Trek, the motion picture, as a nice way to, like, how do you see something when you are in deep space and you're far away from a sun? I like that as an answer. It felt fresh and different. And boy, trying to do something fresh and different in space after all of the sci-fi shows that have been done is a big challenge. And I felt like when Roger Guyette did J.J. Abrams' Star Trek film in 2009, that I was really pleased that he had a very different style book. And, you know, one of the big style book items was on that was, hey, the Enterprise is really big. It's really big, and it's so big that, that you know, it's always breaking frame. And
okay.
I really liked that. It felt different.
Yeah. So you're obviously now in a position where, given the right time frames and resources, you can pretty much produce anything. So I guess my question is the issue now, because you mentioned earlier, you know, like it looked like you could do new things, but is it now really a matter of shifting to what's authentic? And if it is like that, it resonates with the audience because it's more authentic, is that why people you think have responded so much to Grogu as a puppet? Because they feel like some kind of authenticity that maybe, because I mean, it's not a technical impossibility. We know that you can make an incredibly good digital character. Like, you know, that's possible.
Oh, yeah. I think that if you talk to Richard Bluff, who was the client-side soup on Mandalorian, on the streaming series, that I think the original plan was that Grogu was going to be CG anytime you got a good look at him, but they were worried about the cost of that because he's in so much of the show that, hey, shouldn't we have, you know, what amounts to a stuffy, you know, some version of it that if Mando is holding him and running through the shot, or he's in way in the background, or he's out of focus, that, hey, maybe that gets us 30% of the shots, and, you know, 30% of that many shots is going to be a big cost savings. And so that it would be really good lighting reference as well. And our friends at Legacy built this spectacular puppet. And as they do, they always over-deliver. And it was capable of quite a lot more than I think what everyone was really expecting it to be. And, you know, just seeing it on set, I think they started feeling like, you know, hey, this may hold up for more than we thought. And gradually the methodology shifted to puppet first. You know, use the puppet for everything that you can, and we'll fill in with CG for the things that, you know, we fail with on set, or that the puppet's just not capable of doing.
In Zelen Mechanics, for example, yeah, which are also like puppeteered, like there's a scene where they're climbing some vines or whatever, and it's incredibly yeah, obvious to anyone that's kind of like being a dork like I am and being technical, that a traditional animator would be able to articulate their hands better climbing and just sort of articulate. But yet audiences totally love them. So almost not because they're fooled or that they're confused or in any way like it's a realism issue. They just adore them because they have this kind of, I can't come up with this word authenticity, a kind of like a tangible nature that just seems to resonate with the audience, which I think is a really interesting thing, that you literally, from my point of view, technically could do a better job animating a character digitally, and yet audiences seem to respond.
Yeah, I'll say that Jon Favreau's feeling is that part of the charm of the original trilogy was to some extent that you could tell that these were guys in rubber masks or puppets, and that's okay. That's part of how people remember the original trilogy, and that sort of handcrafted nature of it is something to be embraced rather than eliminated. And so when we have puppets in the show, that it's okay that you know that they're puppets, you know, that's okay.
And but it must make your animators have to animate the digital to be indistinguishable.
You're not always seeing a puppet. You know, there are times when there was some thing we needed to depict that the puppet couldn't really do. And we needed to use the CG model in there. And then it becomes a challenge of, okay, we need to don't animate this with perfect foot contact or weight, the perfect weight and balance. You got to animate it so that it feels like you're seeing the puppet. And that sort of extended even to things that were all CG, you know, from the plan all the way at the beginning, is to limit the range of motion and the level of articulation of some of these characters so that they kind of fit into the same aesthetic as the rest of the movie that has so many puppets in it.
You're talking about embracing the practical. Talk to me, if you could, about the Razor Crest and the... Because obviously Mandalorian was at the forefront of light stage LED volumes in mm-hmm. the TV show, and you got incredibly interesting with the Razor Crest. Do you want to tell me about that with a miniature version?
Yeah, we built it a little miniature LED volume miniature, to go yeah. with the miniature ship, yeah. That was something that I had really wanted to do all the way from season one. And I took a poor man's stab at it on season one, where I built an enclosure out of foam core around the ship and used projectors to project imagery onto it to try and get sort of a poor man's version of the volume. And it sort of worked. You know, the color wasn't great on it. And in the end, as we were putting those shots together, you know, we got a first version of the shot together, and Favreau wanted to change the flight path of the ship. And then, like, all right, well, we've already shot it, so it's you've got to switch to CG on that. So we ended up not using that element. So I never really found out if I could have pushed it far enough to make it work on the show. But I'd always been thinking about that, and it'd be nice to do this properly with real LED volume. And at the conclusion of the shoot, our Manhattan Beach volume was decommissioned. We took it apart and dismantled it, took it off the stage. And, you know, we owned all those panels. So I said, hey, could I get enough panels shipped up to us to build an 8 foot by 8 foot by 8 foot cube? Four sides, you know, with the open on the bottom and open on one side, so I can shoot into it from the outside, so I can shoot this bare metal ship in environments that aren't just space shots. Because kind of looking through the whole wish list of shots that I wanted to do with the miniature, many of them were flying through atmosphere or parked on the ground or something, and I wanted to expand beyond what we'd done on the streaming show with pretty much only tackling these shots in space. And
so was that still a matter of doing passes? And if it was passes, yeah. How many passes did you do?
Well, I was explaining the fact that I have a motion control system available to me, and that you know, in theory, it all just repeats exactly. So
yeah.
In the good old days on the original trilogy, they tried to limit the total number of passes, mostly for stage time. So they would wedge key and fill and all of that. And in general, they would shoot beauty pass against blue screen, and they'd shoot engines separately. And that was kind of it. And but I want, knowing how many times I'm in dailies, kind of looking at, well, I wish the fill was just a half stop darker and a little bit cooler. I really wanted those to be separate image streams so that you know, we're essentially giving the compositor motion control AOVs, right? So
yeah.
I would separate as many things as I could to try and give me as much flexibility later in the comp. So for a shot that's in daylight, I would shoot sunlight as a pass. If we're in the LED volume, we do the environment, LED environment as a pass. Engines, running lights, blue screen, And then
was it literally blue screen or?
Yeah, it was literally blue screen.
Okay. Because back in the day, there used to be all sorts of clever things to get, you know, like red with narrow kind of frequency response so that you could really be able to nail that kind of color. And also red wasn't very common in ships. But of course, with modern keying, on top of which I have no idea what the LED volumes like. Was it still the LED volume that was producing the blue? Because it's, I don't know what its frequency response was.
No, there's definitely a moiré issue that comes along with the LED screen. And in fact, it's sort of a little bit worse shooting with miniatures than it is in live action.
Because the relative
because the whole thing scaled down. Yeah, effectively the dots get bigger. Yeah. And one of the things that we saw immediately, because that was one of my first thoughts is, hey, I can just put a perfect blue screen up there. But the reality is, especially when you're stopped all the way down to carry depth, as much depth of field as you can, because you're shooting miniatures, you don't want to have shallow depth of field.
You want all the depth of field in the world, yeah.
That you get geometric aliasing, where you imagine you put a diagonal line in front of the raster grid of the LED screens, and you're either covering up an LED or you're not, and you get jaggies along the edge.
Like the staircasing from on and offness of the LEDs.
Oh, yeah. And it's pretty visible. So even if the image that you're shooting, the dots are small enough that they sort of blend together and get you what appears to be a pretty continuous even image, you'd see those little jaggies on the edges, and that was actually pretty bad. And so in general, when we were shooting the ship in front of the LED screen, we used some of our Stagecraft tools to kind of know where the camera was and where the ship was, and we'd put a little dark area right behind the ship so that at least the edge of the ship didn't have something bright behind it to create that jaggy problem.
Were you trying to get halation on the volume passes? Were you trying to get, like, because one of the things in space is you get that, like, the light really blooms and kind of halates, and I was wondering whether that was, like, post effect, or was that you actually trying to do that in camera with the volume pass?
Well, the LED volume's fairly high dynamic range. You know, bright things can get pretty bright on it. I was trying to shoot a pretty clean image because it was always going to get comped into a different background. So I didn't want to have something glaring on the wall that would wrap into the imagery of the ship. Figure let's save that for the comp. I did shoot an old trek that goes all the way back to the to New Hope was that when you're shooting engines, you shoot with a diffusion filter. In fact, back on season one, my memory of, you know, when I started at ILM and I was a camera assistant, that when we shot engine passes, we had a set of diffusion filters and we had a set of double fog filters. And my memory from like Captain EO and Star Tours was that that the preferred we would use a double fog 3 was the most common filter for.
Is that partly because you'd expect the heat from the engines and kind of distortion?
It's to make that sort of classic Star Wars glow around the engines. So the engine, it would be a light in the engine cone, and when you photograph it through the double fog, you would get that big glow around it. And that's one of the other reasons to make the engines a separate pass. It's if those wanted to be shot with the diffusion filter to get that glow. And you know, when we started on this, I had thought I remembered that I should get a couple of double fog filters for the lenses I'm going to use. And I ran into Peter Dalton, who was camera assistant on Return of the Jedi. And I said, hey, can you check my memory on this? I seem to remember we did the engine glows with these double fog filters. And I mostly remember double fog 2 Double Fog 3 as being the ones that were the most common. He said, oh, I'll look it up. And the next day, he brought a document in that he left on my desk, and it was a Xerox copy from of a list of all the models, what their power voltage was, you know, that this X-Wing model gets 17 volts, and the preferred exposure is 1 second at F-16 with this filter. And so you had the whole list of, like, every model from Return of the Jedi and the recommended.
Is that Lucasfilm Archives kicking it, or did he actually have copies?
No, he had it in his own collection.
I was going to say, that's really impressive.
Yeah, that was.
I can't find notes from like last week.
Yeah, you know, I had a similar thing happen to me on Phantom Menace when we were. I did the crawl at the beginning of the film, and I asked again. I asked Peter Dalton, "Hey, you wouldn't know off the top of your head what lens you guys shot the crawls with?" He said, "I'm going to look it up." And again, he brought me a Xerox copy of a camera report from Return of the Jedi that listed the lens on there. So it was 24 millimeter VistaVision.
Brilliant. I was going to also say, and look, I might have got the scene order wrong, but I think when they break out of the sort of fight stadium thing, there's a shot looking down a kind of a night street. And what was interesting about that for me is that because it had a classic wet down, but at the end of the street, as I understand it, there was an LED, not so much of a volume, it's just an LED insert, which then allowed the street to extend. I was dead curious whether that was the only time that was used, and also whether or not that facilitated the camera moving to change perspective, and like you were actually tracking that through a, or was it more just like a sort of a static POV?
Well, in pre-production, John Favreau was always in our art department meetings. We're doing our negotiations about what gets what's going to be a volume set, how much do we build, what's going to be a conventional set, what's the thing we're going to do on the back lot or at a location, and he was always cautious when we. We're proposing volume sets of, hey, we've got to be really careful about this. There's a tendency to design sets that are roughly circular at about 110 feet in diameter because that's the size of our volume. And it's always a good idea to kind of break up and subvert people's expectations so they don't kind of know where the seams are going to be. And that was kind of, that discussion was fresh in my mind when we were talking about what we were going to do for the streets in Shikari. And Andrew Jones found a location, the SCS warehouse in downtown LA, that had sort of the right character, had a nice floor, and it had other structures that looked good. And it was meant to be the main drag of Shikari. And we were going to redress it a couple of times to be different parts of the city. And in several of those, like outside the arena and the salt bar and the main drag where, you know, this big crane shot booming down to follow Mando as he goes to talk to the Martin Scorsese's character, you're meant to see way off into the distance, down miles away. And, you know, rather than put a process screen down there, the thought was, hey, that's a perfect use case for, let's erect a big LED wall there, put in the tracking cameras, and then we'll make that one of our volume sets. And so it wasn't like in the original volume. It was, an LED wall that where the perspective tracks as the camera moves. And the wetted down floor, as you know, it was a really nice way to help sell the effect.
Yeah, it really did sell it incredibly well. And speaking of water, kind of tangentially, when the dragon snake sequence kind of happened, when Mando's dropped through the floor, which was a nice, callback, I'm just wondering, like, clearly there's a lot of digital work there, but it's got an actor in a fluid, in water, And you've got a lot of stuff going on digitally. And I was just sort of like wondering how you approach that sequence, because technically it's, you know, it's like you have to have any character in water, obviously creating waves in the water, but you also have to have the actual actor in something. And it all becomes like really hard when it's sort of overlapping. I would love you to talk through that.
Well, we had a set piece that had, you know, it was a tank with about 3 feet of water in it. And so we shot everything with the, with Pedro and our stunt performer kind of sloshing around through various depths of water. And then it's, every shot is kind of a blend, different amounts. You know, some of them were able to retain most of the photographed live action water. Other ones, it's fully replaced, and others, it's some blend, because the getting the water interaction right around a live action character is tricky. If you've got the a real photographed element, hey, you want to retain that as much as you can, but then you need good looking water sims around the creature. So it's,
and reflected light and everything else that goes with it.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I remember on the Pirates movies how hard it was to make CG water look like anything. Like, it was a real struggle to make things look good. And the team we had, Tanya Richards supervised that work up in our Vancouver studio. And I thought the water sims were terrific on that. They really did a spectacular job.
100%. Yeah, it was a great sequence, but also just a nice addition of like fully digital characters into that environment that sort of felt really familiar. Was it hard doing any of the character work? I mean, you mentioned Martin Scorsese's character, which is just like having him talk about gangsters was just, you know, sublime. But also you had to have a Hutt character verbalizing differently with different visemes and stuff. Was any of that challenging to get?
Oh yeah. In fact, I'd say that the Rada character is probably the single biggest challenge on the show. And it's not that it was a technical challenge. It was more conceptual that, you know, we know Jabba the Hutt from Return of the Jedi of this sedentary blob-like monster that speaks an alien language. And there's a stylization there of, you know, the sort of puppety lip sync where he's, you know, a lot that you can get away with there. And when you read in the script that, okay, we're going to do an athletic fighting Hutt that moves fast, is sympathetic and speaks English, you know, that's one thing to write that down and another thing to try and turn that into compelling looking imagery. So we knew that was something that we're going to have to iterate on, like to, you know, to do motion studies of, all right, well, how does he move? We can't get away with him just being in one place and try and hide motion via editorial cuts. You know, there's times we're going to have to actually see him move. So how does he move? Does he move like a snake? Does he move like a inchworm? Does he move like a, like an elephant seal?
And how often did the role, when did the role come in? Because the role is kind of the, his kind of, you know, go-to move.
I'm not sure who came up with that, but it was during the, that whole, like, how do we get him to move thing? And yeah, and I thought that was a really clever one. And it's, let's say, a really good way for him to, if he's about a meter in diameter, then, you know, he can very quickly be 3.14 meters away in just a fraction of a second. And then how closely do you match to Jabba in terms of things like level of phoneme articulation and and skin texture and that kind of thing. And we certainly extended the style book somewhat. To go back to the level of articulation, yeah, we went through a whole bunch of tests on, you know, how much do you form specific phonemes? Obviously, Java doesn't really, you know, it's sort of mouth is just open and closed. And we found you can't really get away with that when he's speaking English, that you've got to do a little bit more than that. And he's meant to be a sympathetic character as he's delivering dialogue. You want to kind of read emotion in him and feel some empathy for him. So he's got to be a little bit more expressive than that. So I'd like to think we found a good balance where you can read emotion and expression in him, but he doesn't feel too overly articulated. That was definitely that was probably the biggest challenge.
Yeah, it was a bit of a son of immigrant feel, right? Like you get parent that's come from the motherland and they speak the native tongue, and then the next generation is brought up in whatever America and speaks English, and there's a link between the two, but they're kind of a generational shift in language, which is the way I interpreted it.
I was worried when you know, because originally the twins, the sort of villainous huts that are more the sedentary types that we're used to seeing, when John told me that I think we're going to have them speak English in places, like it can't all just be subtitled, I thought, oh man, that's going to be tricky to do that. But I was really happy with the solution of they're not native English speakers, so it's kind of a strain for them to do, and it feels a little affected and stilted. And I think that comes across really very well.
And then, was that the reason that the twins weren't like puppets or big itches or whatever? Because you could have, they don't animate in a fight sequence. They don't like do the.
They're in that big fight at the. At the
end. Okay, sure. Yeah.
The big elephant seal fight at the end was something that that I thought was a bold choice to do. And we spent a bunch of time on that trying to figure out how do you make huts fight. And the big inspirations were sumo wrestling and nature documentaries of walruses and elephant seals fighting on the beach.
So of those characters that we've been discussing, and maybe a few others like Emo, are there any that you particularly enjoyed supervising through? Because there was the fisherman and a whole bunch of interesting characters.
Yeah, that is the Gatori character that our friends at Image Engine did. There's Zeb, sort of a carryover from Mando Season 3. He's in a few shots there, but he had a lot more business here than our friends at ILP did. Hybrid did the Martin Scorsese Hugo character, and I thought they did very well with that.
I thought he was very good.
Some good acting there with and the voice performance was pretty priceless.
Just an unexpected cameo.
You know, when we shot the scene originally, John hadn't cast Marty to do that, so we didn't know who it was going to be, and it wasn't until we got into post that he approached Marty and he agreed to do it. But the video of those voice recording sessions is hilarious because, you know, he's making all the hand gestures and the that was really entertaining.
Yeah, that was an inspired piece of direction for sure. I mean, you get the impression that Jon Favreau has great affection for the material and great affection for the craft, which I've got to say, in an age where everybody's like kind of pretending like everything's done in camera and kind of poo-pooing VFX, Favreau's been a good champion for the artists that work so hard on all the shots.
Yeah, I don't love the trend of kind of denying the use of visual effects. It's
Yes.
You know, I don't think there's any other discipline that gets so routinely insulted as the visual effects department.
Yes. And there are often the case where the thing that they're pretending was literally physically impossible to be done. Or the story is set, not in your case, but, you know, other films where it's set in space and you're like, we know that that's not real, right? There's no one here that actually thinks that happened. But yeah, please maintain the myth that it was all done. Also, this idea that things are done for real, like what is unreal about using like any of the filmmaking tools, right? They're all as real as each other. These guys aren't actually bounty hunters. They're not actual doctors. They're not actually killing each other. This is all make-believe in the first place. So,
Yeah, I think Jon Favreau's got a really healthy attitude about these things that, you know, there's a whole team. Film is a collaborative art, and you need people who are really good at all disciplines coming together and working well, and you know, use the best tool for the job to make the final imagery. And there's something that George Lucas told me once years ago when he was bemoaning that the same, you know, people complain about films with visual effects in them that, you know, I want films that are real. And he said, I got news for you, man. Like nothing in films is real. That's not a real hospital that they're in. Those aren't their real clothes. Somebody wrote the words that they're saying. It's all fake. There's nothing real in movies.
Yes. Yes, so true. And but of course, half of the craft of ILM and others that work on the film is to do invisible effects where no one's kind of aware of them. But yes, there are times when it so obviously has to be done through cinema technology, and to claim that it isn't is just to be, you know, disingenuous. But John, thanks so much for talking to us, John. We really appreciate it. It's great seeing that the evolution of what you've been doing and the teams and what they managed to produce. And as I say, this kind of authenticity that seems to resonate so much with people that love to go and see the film. So thanks again for taking time to talk to us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a treat.
Thanks again, John, for joining us here on the FX Podcast and diving into the work done on the film, as well as sharing a bit of historical perspective about the Star Wars franchise. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening to or watching this FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.